This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Potentially bad news for people who have recovered from COVID-19. Antibodies might not last very long. But there is promising new antibody research with llamas.
It's pretty amazing. The llamas are really unusual.
Also, a new film tells the story of the invasion of Iraq through the eyes of Iraqis. This translator says he was ready to work for the U.S. for a dollar.
And they were like, would $50 be okay?
$50 was my dad's salary for 6 months.
And Norway is easing coronavirus restrictions and opening up to lovers.
My fiance called me and she was just bawling. I'm like, oh no, what's wrong? She's like, no, you can finally come.
I'm Carol Hills. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Too many nations are heading in the wrong direction.
The virus remains public enemy number one.
Words of warning this week from the head of the World Health Organization, Tedros Ghebreyesus. He said mixed messages from leaders are undermining any response.
We need to reach a sustainable situation where we have adequate control of this virus without shutting down our lives entirely or lurching from lockdown to lockdown.
Here in the U.S., several states are reimposing restrictions to try and contain the virus. In Europe, they're desperately trying to avoid heading back into quarantine. London Mayor Sadiq Khan told Sky News today that now is the time to make sure all the protective measures are in place.
What none of us wants is a second lockdown. The lockdown was awful for a variety of reasons, and that's why I'm frustrated at the delay from the government making face coverings mandatory in shops. I don't know why they've waited this long.
A face covering in shops in England becomes mandatory at the end of next week. Masks, social distancing, no large gatherings. We're just going to have to get used to it until we have a vaccine. And for those of you who've had the coronavirus and think you're now immune, well, maybe not. New research from King's College London suggests that people who've recovered may lose their immunity within months. That doesn't sound good. Stuart Neal is a professor of virology and the study's co-author. I asked him how seriously we should take the latest developments.
The first thing I would say is that this isn't really that bad news. So what we've looked at is the presence of what are called neutralizing antibodies in the blood. And a study led by my colleague, Katie Dawes, has found that these antibodies that people make after they've been infected and block viruses getting into the cells that they naturally target are lost from the blood quite quickly after infection. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you're not immune to the virus anymore. But what we do know about other coronaviruses is that they tend to be seasonal and you can be reinfected if not, but not get a particularly bad infection. So I wouldn't necessarily say that this study shows people will not be immune anymore, but it does put some certain caveats on that immunity.
I mean, enough to kind of make it a little discouraging, really. I mean, I think the conventional wisdom has been if you get coronavirus, you're immune. And that's behind the whole notion of herd immunity and kind of getting us through this pandemic. Does this study change that scenario?
Well, I mean, actually, when you look at other human coronaviruses, that's never been the case. One of the peculiarities about these viruses is that that you're not immune to infection for any great length of time. But by and large, these viruses don't tend to cause much in the way of problematic disease. So the hope really here would be that the immunity that you're left with after you've been infected with SARS-CoV-2 would prevent you from getting seriously ill again afterwards. but it might not stop you getting infected. And that's one of the caveats we might have to bear in mind. But this is, again, is really just a first glance at one of the immune responses that's particularly easy to look at in the blood. And at the moment, we don't know what immune responses would be required to protect somebody.
What significance does it have in terms of developing a vaccine to fight this virus?
So in our study, what we found was that people who had been infected and been seriously ill tended to have much higher levels of these neutralizing antibodies than people who had only had mild infection where they hadn't had to go to hospital. And it's in those mild infections that this neutralizing antibodies drop off fast. So one of the potential issues with a vaccine might be that it's quite easy to make these antibodies, but if they don't last, you might have to be boosted fairly regularly. And you might want to do that particularly in patients who would be at, or people who would be at risk.
You sound pretty ho-hum about all this, like it was expected. Are you at all surprised by your finding, or do you think this is just the latest iteration and this is how it goes with these coronaviruses and we just got to work through it?
I think what's key to all of this is that at the moment we're just trying to find out what's going on. And in a lot of other respiratory viral infections, people don't look at the immune responses, certainly the antibody responses, in this amount of detail. So I'm not sure whether we should be surprised about these results or not. It's just that we're all looking at them. But, you know, antibodies go up, antibodies come down. What's important is that the immune system is left with a memory of it. And that memory can often be very rapidly reactivated to stop you getting particularly ill, even if you do subsequently get infected. So, I mean, I don't think there's anything intrinsically bad about this news. It's just we're watching what happens and we're trying to interpret what that means for vaccine design and people's susceptibility to disease going forward.
Stuart Neal is Professor of Virology at King's College London. Thanks a lot for speaking with us.
Thank you.
We just heard that English shoppers will be required to wear a mask soon. English subway riders have been required to mask up on public transit since mid-June. Still, a well-placed reminder helps. Enter Banksy. The street artist's latest work can be found in London's underground subway. A video posted on his Instagram page today shows a man, believed to be the enigmatic artist, disguised as a member of the cleaning staff. He instructs passengers to move away while he stencils rats around the inside of a train carriage. The work is called If You Don't Mask, You Don't Get. It features several rats wearing face masks. Another rodent appears to be sneezing. And a different rat is shown offering hand sanitizer. At the end of the video, Banksy sprays the words, I get locked down, but I get up again. I get no doubt. If you want to check out that video, we've got it up at theworld.org. One country where coronavirus cases are surging is Mexico. It now has the fourth highest number of deaths worldwide, 35,000. That's the official tally. It's hard to get accurate numbers in Mexico, but frontline healthcare workers are feeling the toll. Shannon Young reports from Oaxaca in southwest Mexico.
Since the start of July, the total number of confirmed COVID-19 deaths in Mexico has surpassed that of Spain, France, and Italy.
Pues tenemos que estar dando información.
President Andrés Manuel López Obrador seemed unfazed in his most recent Sunday address to the nation. He says the intensity of the outbreak is easing and the country is in good hands. He expressed more concern about what he calls the other pandemic.
La otra pandemia. Del alarmismo.
That would be, in his words, the alarmist conservative press. The president takes issue with reporting overall mortality comparisons, saying it's more informative to see the death tolls scaled to population. Mexico has more than twice as many residents as the European countries hardest hit by the virus. But accurate comparisons are hard to make, given Mexico's widely acknowledged case undercount. Mexico has the lowest per capita testing rate in the Western Hemisphere and the world's highest rate of tests that come back positive. Health officials say all patients sick enough to require hospitalization are tested, but only 1 in 10 patients with mild symptoms qualifies for a test under the country's so-called Sentinel surveillance model.
How it works is you have to perform sickness.
Ulises Moreno Tavares received a test at a public clinic in the southern state of Guerrero after several days of symptoms. He has an autoimmune condition, but it wasn't enough to automatically qualify for a test.
When I went in, I didn't have a fever. And so I had to compensate saying, I don't have it right now, but oh my God, it was terrible like 2 days ago. And it was, but like the way you express it, you have to perform illness in order to be believed.
His results took more than 30 days to come back. They were positive. Moreno Tavares says not having the results for so long led him to do things he wouldn't have done had he known otherwise.
Perhaps the most prominent is that I had to go out and buy groceries. I would normally do that because I live alone, but in this case scenario, I would have tapped much deeper into my networks to find help.
Mexico has a massive backlog of tests. Lag times can undermine self-isolation and hinder contact tracing efforts, which in turn can contribute to spread by people who don't even know they've been exposed. Health officials update confirmed case numbers daily, but medical workers say they don't reflect the realities inside hospitals.
I feel like I can't just look at the numbers anymore.
Dr. Mandeep Dhillon is a Canadian physician who works in the emergency room of a regional hospital in the Mexican city of Orizaba. She says there's not enough testing of the general population to get a sense of potential hospital caseloads or to catch asymptomatic carriers. Dr. Dhillon was speaking from home isolation after coming down with symptoms of COVID. She says the sheer scope of the pandemic is taking a toll on both the physical and mental health of medical workers.
It's very clear in my mind the day that I feel like all of this just hit me in a particular way. And it happened just listening to a colleague of mine talking about how hopeless he felt.
Dhillon says one of the hardest aspects of the job has been seeing how the virus robs loved ones of the solace and closure of their final moments together. She says the effect on hospital workers has been a combination of exhaustion and spiritual lesions.
And I think we're suffering heartbreak daily. And then on top of that, the frustration of hearing official accounts of how things are not that bad and that if folks are going to die, it's because, you know, the illness is just difficult. And in any case, they were probably diabetics to begin with. And then just contrasting that with the faces that we see in the ER and sometimes being in touch with their family members and seeing the difficult time that they're going through.
Mexican health officials have argued the country's scarce testing policy allows them to channel limited resources towards expanding bed space for the critically ill. But adequate health care requires personnel, and many of them are becoming infected. A report released Monday by Amnesty International found COVID infections among healthcare workers in Mexico ran into the thousands, and deaths stood at nearly 250. Here in the state of Oaxaca, one in five confirmed cases of COVID is a healthcare worker. In one city, an entire hospital was shut down temporarily because more than 60% of its staff had been exposed to the virus. Many government healthcare workers are reluctant to go on record to counter the official story that every COVID patient can find a hospital bed. But cracks are starting to show.
El hospital de especialidades de la ciudad de Oaxaca ya no tiene espacio suficiente.
Unionized healthcare workers from Oaxaca's biggest hospitals released a video over the weekend saying their facilities either lack bed space or personnel. They urged residents to stay home despite a recent easing of restrictions. Mexico's threadbare public health system is in for a long haul as cases continue to accumulate, while sparse testing gives frontline workers little time to prepare for blows they are expected to weather. For The World, I'm Shannon Young in Oaxaca, Mexico.
You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. A new film premiering tonight on PBS's Frontline tells the story of the Iraq War, but not the way we saw it in America.
We never thought that Saddam would be removed. Never. So when I saw them, I felt hope. A country like America. This was my dream.
Once Upon a Time in Iraq takes us back to 2003. Iraqis describe how they experienced the U.S.-led invasion of Baghdad, the capture and execution of Saddam Hussein, and the years of chaos that followed. James Blumel directed the film and joins us now from London. James, why did you make this film now?
Well, I had just finished a long documentary following the sort of European refugee crisis, and the rise of the far right and nationalism in Europe sort of doesn't see that they have any sort of ownership over what the core problems were in the Middle East, the rise of Islamic terrorism and ISIS and destabilization of the region, which all can really be stemmed from 2003. So I decided I want to sort of make this film to give some sort of context to what we're seeing at the moment.
One of the Iraqis who tells his story is this man, Walid Nassif.
Right after the invasion, one of the very few jobs that you can do in Iraq is to work as a translator. I was ready to work for a dollar. And they were like, would $50 be okay? $50 was my dad's salary for 6 months. I was making it in a day.
Now, Walid, he's a lively guy. Tell us about him.
Walid, in 2003... was, you know, what? How old was he? 18 years old. And he was the lead singer of probably Iraq's only heavy metal band. And I just thought, that guy doing that then is going to have an interesting take on the world. And I wonder what happened to him after that. So I tracked him down and contacted him. And he was living in Canada. And I said, can you tell me, you know, what happened to you?
Early on in the film, Walid makes it clear that he was just in love with the West, totally infatuated. How did the war affect that?
He was infatuated with the West. He was like many young Iraqi teenagers at that time. They were like sort of teenagers anywhere. And when they heard that America was going to come and set them free, there was a belief that they were going to turn Iraq into a country like America. And that, for them, would have been amazing. That's what they wanted. That's what many people wanted. They wanted to become a good country like America.
Of course, things went terribly awry and the country was, and to some degree still is, mired in instability. How did the war and its aftermath affect Walid and his idea about the West?
He realized very quickly that actually what was being delivered was not the land of dreams. It was not making a country like America. And the war took a kid that was incredibly pro-Western values, and it turned that kid into someone that was the opposite. It was anti-America. It did a hell of a job on him.
You speak with several Iraqi women as well. One of them is a woman from the farming countryside north of Baghdad. Her name is Kusai, and when we meet her, she talks about what life was like under Saddam Hussein. She's saying there that there were days when people in her area had absolutely nothing to eat. She says her family used to survive on chicken feed. So she must have been glad to see the fall of Saddam. How does she describe the U.S. invasion and what followed?
Iraq is a land of full of contradictions, and Kusai sort of personifies some of those contradictions. Yes, Saddam Hussein massacred her village, including members of her own family. But at the same time, she recognizes that she knew where she stood with Saddam. As long as you towed the party line, you were going to be protected by Saddam. And that sense of security, that's what was removed completely. You know, life under Saddam, at least you knew where the problem was. It laid with Saddam. But once he was removed, it was everywhere.
An important chapter in your film comes in 2011. That's when Islamic State and ISIS took over important parts of Iraq. How did this affect people like Kusai?
Well, Kusai lived in an area of Iraq which was governed by ISIS. And their sort of unique and horrific way of ruling meant that her husband was executed in the very early days. And she lived opposite an American army base. It's called the Spiker Base. The American army had left it, and it was being used by the Iraqi army, who are mainly Shia. And so there was a lot of young Shia cadets in there. And ISIS took that over. ISIS are mainly Sunni. And when they took over that base, they rounded up those cadets and they massacred them. It was one of the sort of biggest atrocities ISIS had ever committed to date. And a few of those cadets managed to escape and crossed the river into Kusai's farm, where she hid them in her barn and her house. ISIS often were in the area. They sort of searched her house, so she was taking a massive risk. And I asked her why she took that risk, because, you know, we're fed this narrative that Iraq is split on sectarian lines, and she is Sunni and she's helping Shia. How did she do that? And she said that ISIS have nothing to do with religion, nothing to do with Sunni or Shia. They're just monsters. And when she saw those young boys in that position, it was her duty as an Iraqi to help, because they are Iraqi. It's got nothing to do with sectarian divisions.
What's Umm Qusay's life like these days?
She still lives in the same area. She's got bodyguards now because, you know, she's very near the top of the list on the ISIS hit list. She's someone they would very greatly like to get rid of. You know, when I met her, she took me to a restaurant and we walked in, and it was a bit like walking in with like royalty or something. People sort of like, oh, it's Umm Qusay, and they're, sit here, please. And people were taking her photos and asking for, you know, she's famous and she's got the respect of everyone there.
Now, I want to go back to Waleed. How was his life affected when ISIS became dominant in Iraq?
Waleed, by that stage, he had become a refugee and had resettled in Canada, but his family was still in Baghdad.
I was back in Canada. My brother called me and he was like, Daesh just took over Tikrit.
And he saw on the news, he saw the progress that ISIS were making towards Baghdad. His father is Shia. His father was in the army. If ISIS make it to Baghdad, the first people to be rounded up and shot will be his father and his family, his brothers. And there he was in Toronto, not being able to do much about it, except for, look, here's some money, get yourselves on a plane and get to Turkey, become refugees. And he managed, within a very short space of time, to get his whole family to Turkey.
Does Waleed look back and think, the U.S. should never have invaded, we should have stuck it out with Saddam? I mean, what is the 2020 hindsight from him?
The 2020 hindsight, I think, for a lot of Iraqis is the contradiction. Someone that I spoke to said the worst thing America did was invade Iraq. The second worst thing they did was to leave. When America did eventually pull out, they hadn't fixed Iraq. It didn't stand up on its own and it imploded. So for a lot of people, they think if you're going to come in here and wreck a country, the least you can do before you leave is to make sure it can stand up on its own. And that didn't happen.
The film is called Once Upon a Time in Iraq, and it airs on PBS Frontline tonight. We've been speaking with the director, James Blumel. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Here at The World, we bring you the critical stories of the day with context and firsthand perspectives. We bring you those stories every day on the radio, but also in our newsletter. It's called The Top of the World. Our dedicated team sends it out weekday mornings. Sign up by heading to theworld.org/newsletters. You're listening to The World. Being gay is still illegal in many parts of the world, but seeking asylum and proving that you're gay can be tough.
People will present pictures of themselves holding hands with their partners, and they'll often get the response, anyone could take a picture of themselves holding hands.
And later, llamas to the rescue, coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of WGBH in Boston and PRX. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson announced a major reversal today and a victory for the Trump administration. Britain said it is banning equipment from the Chinese technology giant Huawei. New equipment can't be installed within wireless networks, and existing gear needs to be removed within 7 years. Critics say Beijing could use Huawei's technology for espionage. The company disputes this. Regardless, Britain's U-turn sends a strong signal to Beijing. Nigel Inkster is a former director with the British Secret Intelligence Service, SIS, also known as MI6. He currently is a senior advisor at the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London. Nigel Inkster, what exactly did the British government decide to do about Huawei, and how do you understand this decision?
Well, at the beginning of the year, on the basis of the best technical advice available, the UK decided to allow Huawei to take part in 5G at the edge, not the core, and to limit the percentage of Huawei input to 35%. This reflected a perception that this approach could mitigate the risks of malign activity. Now, at the time, this was already seen as somewhat controversial in some circles, particularly, shall we say, the more right-wing nationalist elements of the Conservative Party. And thereafter, we saw a rising tide of effort to get this decision overturned, which the US government was quite clearly encouraging from the sidelines.
So you think this U-turn by the UK is because of pressure from the US?
To a significant degree, I believe that it is, yes.
Let's say that this is a political decision by the UK. What will its practical impact be on Britain's rollout of 5G mobile networks?
I think it's bound to delay it. It's bound to make it more expensive because the telecommunications companies who've already installed 3 and 4G Huawei components will have to strip them out. We're making life more difficult for ourselves, no question about it.
Nigel Engster, do you yourself have any concerns about using Huawei technology in the UK's 5G networks for, you know, national security reasons? Do you buy into any of that?
Well, I never thought at the very outset it was a good idea, and I said so at the time. But at that point, China was not seen in the same light as it now is, and I don't think people were as concerned about the potential risks. The proposition then was that Huawei equipment was cheaper than anybody else's, but I was never happy about it because I could foresee a situation like this eventually arising. It is questionable whether in an ideal world you would want the equipment of a state with a very different ideology and, as now seems, a rather expansionist agenda controlling your critical communications networks. And I think the issue with Huawei is not so much about the risks of cyber espionage, because let's face it, China is already heavily engaged in that. But I think we need to look at this from a broader geopolitical perspective, because it's quite clear that China has a strategy of using Huawei and ZTE to shape the future of global communications in ways favorable to China, reliant upon Chinese technology, reliant upon Chinese technical standards. Because were they to achieve that objective, this would give them very considerable global economic and geopolitical leverage. So that is a challenge that we face. The other issue I would highlight here is the extent to which use of Huawei components might facilitate access to UK-generated data sets. At the moment, we have this mindset that security is about paper mark secret or top secret. We're not thinking enough about what large data sets put together and analyzed through artificial intelligence programs might be able to reveal about ourselves that we wouldn't want others to know.
Nigel Engster is a senior advisor at the International Institute for Strategic Studies. Thanks a lot for speaking with us.
Thank you.
In Russia's Far East, near the border with Northeast China, summer is short. The city of Khabarovsk, for example, is known as the world's coldest city of more than 500,000 people. So usually, the warm weather means it's time for swimming, going to the park, or strolling along the riverside walkway. But something different is playing out this summer. Mass protests, as the world's Daniel Offman reports.
It all started with the arrest of a local governor.
Sergei Furgal from the Khabarovsk region was seized on Thursday and flown to Moscow, where he was interrogated and ordered to jail for 2 months.
The alleged crimes committed by Governor Sergei Furgal were serious. Murder and attempted murder, multiple crimes going back to 15 years ago. But the facts are in dispute, to say the least. In the capital of the Khabarovsk region, tens of thousands of people came out to the streets. This is from a video on YouTube, and it shows the kind of thing that doesn't really happen in Russia's Far East. Putin is a thief, they're chanting. And then something even more fundamental. Freedom. That's what they're calling for after the arrest of their governor. So who exactly is Sergei Furgal? And why are people so upset? That's Sergei Naumov. He's an activist and an independent politician. He lives in the Khabarovsk region in a town called Komsomolsk. Naumov tells me that in 2018, the candidate Sergei Furgal got elected basically out of spite. People in the region were tired of electing candidates from United Russia, That's President Vladimir Putin's political party. So they decided to vote for any possible alternative. Наумов says that Sergei Fургал was not supposed to win the election. He wasn't Putin's candidate. He was from a different party. But he says that people in this part of the country liked Sergei Fургал a lot. Fургал became their guy largely because he was not Moscow's first choice. So when he got arrested last week, people felt like it was personal. This is a video posted by the activist Sergei Naumov. It shows a group of protesters with these women saying they support the governor. They want Moscow to set him free. We're tired of living by Moscow's rules, she says. We want to live by our rules, the rules of the Far East. That's Sergei Naumov again. He says he's never seen anything like these protests before, and definitely not in Russia's Far East. Naumov says people are protesting for their future. And a lot of them tell him it's the first time they've ever done anything like this. The protests have been going on for 4 days straight. But the big question now is, will this actually lead to real change?
Все прекрасно понимали, что, скорее всего, его уже не вернут.
Наумов tells me that the protests will probably not lead to the release of their governor anytime soon. But they are sending a strong message to Moscow.
То, что Хабаровский край теперь не будет прежним.
Наумов tells me that Khabarovsk will never be the same. But things can get more dangerous from here on out. These protests so far have been peaceful. Almost no arrests. Naumov says that if they do start arresting people, he may be one of the first to go.
Американцы должны понимать, что Россия не равнозначна Путину и его режиму.
He adds that Americans need to know something about Russia. It's not a monolith, he says. Russia is not owned by Vladimir Putin and his regime. It's a country full of smart and talented people, he says. And they want to live in a free society. For the World, I'm Daniel Offman.
The Me Too movement is gaining momentum in Egypt. Last week, dozens of women came forward with allegations of sexual assault by a student at the American University of Cairo. The story sparked outrage on social media and eventually led to the student's arrest. And now, beyond this one incident, more Egyptian women are coming forward to share their stories. Mozen Hassan is a women's rights activist and founder of the organization Nazra for Feminist Studies. She's speaking to us from Egypt. Mozen, can you tell me more about the sexual assault case that started this?
Weeks ago, many survivors from sexual violence have been gathering on Instagram, telling their horrifying testimonies about this man, one of the previous AUC students.
AUC, of course, is the American University of Cairo.
Yes, yes. One of those survivors, she decided to go to the university and file a case against him, and supposedly he was kicked out from the university. Then a wave of the movement began.
Mozen, why do you think this particular case has inspired so many others to speak out about their experiences? What is it about this case that has touched people?
Honestly, I think that this case is part of a long-standing movement began in Egypt, specifically on the issue of sexual harassment, sexual assault, and rape. This is one of the waves. Maybe people are so into social media these days, or maybe this is the work of the movement and Egyptian women, but its consequences that the issue of sexual violence has a response from the state, it has a response from different institutions, except American University in Cairo. They have a bad response.
What is this man accused of doing, this student at the American University of Cairo?
Because the Egyptian law is so problematic. We have an article defining sexual harassment, but we don't have an article defining sexual violence. And the definition of rape is so limited to the penetration, so other ways of rape is not a rape. It's called in Arabic hadkar, which is affecting women purity. Based on the testimonies, he is accused of rape women and men. But with the limitation of the Egyptian legal system and Egyptian penal code, he has this charge of hurting women purity.
The Egyptian government has been criticized in the past for jailing women who they say offend public morals, you know, like a famous belly dancer. So in the past, you know, women are sort of accused of acting impurely or dressing inappropriately. Did it surprise you in this case that the student who's alleged to have sexually assaulted all these women was arrested relatively quickly?
Honestly, it is not the past. The Egyptian authority is doing all things at the same time. They are arresting this man. They have good public rhetoric about sexual violence. But at the same time, almost daily, they are arresting TikToker women for hurting the values of the Egyptian family. And at the same time, they are jailing women human rights defenders and activists and accusing feminists like me. As example, I'm banned from traveling. One of the charges against me is that I am encouraging women to have irresponsible liberty. This is something about how there are good women and bad women. And those good women deserve our protection and others they don't deserve.
Does it feel like the national conversation about sexual harassment and sexual assault in Egypt is changing? I mean, are you hopeful?
I'm always hopeful, and honestly, I'm always proud to be part of this movement, because in 15 years, it wasn't this, and now it's more, because societies and people are not static. I'm always proud to be an Egyptian feminist.
Mohsen Hassan is a women's rights activist in Egypt, and she's founder of the organization Nazra for Feminist Studies. Thanks, Mohsen.
Thank you.
Being gay is still illegal in many countries around the world, but 1 in 3 people seeking asylum in Europe because of risk of persecution due to their sexual orientation are routinely rejected. This is according to the findings of a study carried out in Britain, Germany, and Italy over the last 4 years. Moira Dustin from the University of Sussex, who led the UK part of the research, joins me. Moira Dustin, tell me some of the countries they are from.
Cameroon, Nigeria, Uganda, in Africa, in the Middle East, we've got lots of people coming from Syria, Libya, a lot of people coming from Pakistan, and also lots of people coming from Central America as well. You know, all over the world, from some of the many countries where homosexuality, and I'm using the term in inverted commas, is still criminalized.
What sort of proof do they have to present to immigration officials, say in the case of the UK?
It's very difficult for people because they've been hiding their sexuality all their lives. So they're not going to have evidence of relationships or anything really in terms of paperwork to kind of present to make their case. A lot of people we found when they arrive in Europe, whatever country they arrive in, they don't know that you can claim asylum on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. And that leads to problems because they then don't make a claim for asylum as soon as they arrive. And that can be an additional factor that is seen as undermining their credibility when they do come to make a claim.
The statistic we mentioned earlier was that 1 in 3 people seeking asylum in Europe because of risk of persecution due to their sexual orientation are rejected. So for the 1 in 3 who are accepted for asylum, what proof have they provided, or why is their case being accepted and the other 2 out of 3 aren't?
Yeah, I mean, in the UK, I think there's a particular problem, which is that people, if they do claim asylum when they arrive on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity, they won't at that point have the evidence that they need to make their case. So quite often they will be initially refused and then they will spend months or perhaps years waiting for an asylum appeal, during which time they may get involved in LGBT organisations and gather some of the evidence that the Home Office requires to recognise their claim. But it's very difficult. A few years ago, people would be presenting sexually explicit evidence of their relationships to convince decision makers that they really were gay or lesbian. And a European court judgment some years ago ruled that out, rightly said that's completely unacceptable. But it does then mean that people will present pictures of themselves holding hands with their partners or going on pride marches. And they'll often get the response that, anyone could take a picture mm-hmm. of themselves holding hands with someone of the same sex.
But do
that
we know
prove anything?
But do we know in the cases of those who were approved for asylum in the UK, what did they show to prove that?
There's been a shift in recent years to an expectation that people will give an account of some kind of emotional journey. So there will be an expectation that people will have, in their country of origin, at some point had a moment of discovery when they realised they were gay or lesbian. I'm talking specifically about LGB at the moment. And that is the kind of the catalyst for them fleeing their country of origin. And if you can't conform to that narrative, or it doesn't fit your experiences, it's very difficult.
What impact does it have on LGBT asylum seekers not to be believed?
It's really damaging. At a certain point in my interviewing process, I suddenly realized that nearly everyone I'd spoken to had talked about depression, had talked about taking antidepressants. And, you know, it just suddenly hit me that practically everyone I talked to had quite casually almost or taken for granted the fact that they were traumatized, experiencing depression, had real ongoing mental health problems.
Moira Dustin is from the University of Sussex in the UK. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Carol. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
If you spent time in the Andes, you might recognize this sound. A llama. The domesticated relative of the camel has long been revered in South America. The Aymara culture says that the heavenly llama drinks water from the ocean and urinates it as rain. Scientists also revere the animal to do research on viruses, ranging from HIV to influenza. Now they're hoping that llama antibodies can serve as a treatment for COVID-19. Professor James Naismith is the director of the Rosalind Franklin Institute in the UK. He's the lead researcher in a new study on llama antibodies. Professor Naismith, explain what you found in the llama's antibodies and how that can help neutralize the coronavirus in humans.
So llamas have an unusual antibody. And we make them something called a nanobody, which is a part of that antibody. That meant we were able to use molecular biology and were able to turn what the llama makes into a really powerful agent that kills coronavirus.
How have you tested the llama's antibodies so far?
So what we've done after characterizing them with electron microscopy and other technologies, we then tested them against live virus inside petri dishes. So those are dishes covered in human cells, and you expose them to the virus in the presence or in the absence of the llama nanobody. And what we see is when the nanobody is there, even at very, very low concentrations, it completely protects the cells against the virus. So in other words, it destroys the virus before it reaches the cell.
So would the llama antibody be part of a vaccine, or what? How would it actually be used in terms of treating the coronavirus?
So the plan is to use something called passive immunization. For your viewers that remember Dustin Hoffman in, I think the film was Outbreak, the Donald Sutherland character had all these bags of medicine in a cold storage facility. That's passive immunization. You're using the antibodies from people who previously recovered from the virus, and you give their antibodies to somebody who's currently sick. And that clears the virus from the system, allowing people then to recover and for their own systems to get rid of the virus. By using llama nanobodies, we can make these reagents in the lab, have them stockpiled and ready and distributed, rather than have to go around finding people all the time.
So that would be end up in the form of a pill or something like that?
It would probably end up in the form of a transfusion bag, but we're now testing reagents which could be given in a different way, possibly through the nasal, sort of like a puff up the nose. But a lot of that remains to be worked out.
And would it be a sort of a one use only or a recurrent use to actually treat the COVID-19?
That's a really good question. So passive immunization tends to be a one-shot deal. There's also the element with llamas that they're not human, of course. Llamas are closely related to human, but they are different. So we don't know whether your immune system will actually form an immune response to the llama nanobodies. So that won't matter in the first dose, but it might matter if you got a second or third dose. But in fact, passive immunization is a single shot.
Is this antibody genetically unique to llamas, or can it be found in other animals?
You can find it in camels, alpacas, which are, they're all related, of course, they're all camelids. And the other species that has single chain, what we call single chain antibodies, are sharks, but they're even less friendly and easy to deal with than llamas.
Yeah, I'd say so. They're also fluffy and cute, not like a shark.
Alpacas are even better, right?
Yeah, they have those sort of mopped up kind of Beatles haircuts. They look really cute. All right. Thanks a lot. Professor James Naismith is the director of the Rosalind Franklin Institute in the UK.
Thank you for having me on.
And finally today, closed borders during the pandemic have taken long-distance relationships to a whole new level. But at last, some sweet relief for some cross-border couples. Here's the world's Bianca Hillier.
Back in March, Luc DeBoer was weeks away from a new life. He quit his nursing job in Nebraska and had a flight booked to join his fiancée in her home country of Norway. That, obviously, didn't happen.
Found out a week later the borders closed, so then I never knew, like, oh, should I go back to work or try to find a different job? But then I'm like, well, if they open up in a month, it'd be pointless. So it was a hard time not knowing what to expect.
Borders have been closed ever since. Luke's moving date passed, and now so has his wedding date.
We were supposed to get married June 27th. We had a really nice, like, mountain wedding in Norway planned out and everything, and kind of a bummer that this happened, but nobody saw it coming.
Norway has fared far better than the U.S. in the face of the coronavirus. They've had less than 5 deaths per 100,000 people. The U.S. has had 41. Luke and his fiancée, Ida, weren't sure when they'd see each other again. Then Luke got the call he'd been waiting for.
Well, I got like a call at like 5 o'clock in the morning over here. And, like, my fiancée called me and she was just bawling. I'm like, oh no, what's wrong? She's like, no, you can finally come.
Luke can finally go to Norway because of a new rule that benefits couples separated by the pandemic. Starting tomorrow, Norway's government will welcome people from outside the EU if they can prove they're in a real romantic relationship with someone in Norway. According to the government, a real relationship is defined by 2 metrics. The couple has to have been together for at least 9 months, and they have to have met in person at least once. Luke says his 5.5-year relationship passes the test.
I can't find the words to say how happy I am to finally see her again.
His happiness was hard won. Couples separated around the world have joined forces under the hashtags Love is Essential and Love is Not Tourism.
Love matters.
Love matters.
From Scotland to Canada, across international borders, love matters.
A few politicians have paid attention. Denmark and Austria now allow cross-border couples to reunite. And in a recent meeting with EU council members, Moritz Korner, a German member of the European Parliament, advocated for the campaign.
We cannot see the pandemic getting in the way of these people's love. Why is there no exception for these couples? Why don't we do something to ensure these couples can see each other and be together again?
Most countries around the world are not yet allowing separated couples to reunite in order to slow the spread of the virus. But Luke and Ida are jumping on the chance. Luke is getting on a flight first thing tomorrow morning and has plans for a courthouse wedding in Norway before travel restrictions loosen and family can join them for a full ceremony. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills, back tomorrow for another spin of the globe.